Hey, this is Mike Bobbitt. I'm a guy who used to make things, and sometimes I still do. These days, I prefer making podcasts, and I have a new one called Soundtrack to My Life. On this podcast, I talk to different creative people about the music that shaped them. Sometimes the conversations are funny, and sometimes they're just kind of sweet.
I love that Pina Colada song. Yeah, I do.
Rihanna has had a huge impact on my songwriting.
I'm diving into the ocean, finding that one fish that has the toxins, and I'm just drinking those toxins all day.
Maybe they're saying, like, you should now go forth and rock. It's like a peace be with you situation.
I also have a playlist called F-Jams. One into it, just in case.
We dance to a jazz version of My Favorite Things.
Soundtrack to My Life. It's available exclusive on Spotify. It's a exclusive. I'm going to try to make that word take off. It's a music plus talk show, meaning I can play songs in their entirety. So think of this as an interactive playlist with some of the coolest creative people I know, and you should know too. Soundtrack to My Life, a Spotify exclusive.
Welcome back to Great Lakes Confidential. Hey, Marty.
Hey, Angie. How you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Not bad. Not bad.
It is so cold outside.
Yes.
Like, I think we finally hit winter.
Yeah.
And it's
been
like
a couple of years, but we're here.
Yeah. It's like 15 degrees outside or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
I haven't left my house all weekend. I did open the door because there was a package, and then I, you know, promptly closed it and crawled under a blanket. But I have to leave the house tomorrow to go to work, and I'm not looking forward to it. So,
looking, it might be a degree or two warmer.
Here's hoping.
Wear your shorts.
Yeah. So. Well, whatever. I mean, it is what it is, and I should be used to it.
Speaking of which, in typical Michigan fashion, on Friday, saw some guy wearing shorts.
It wasn't my son, was it?
No, but, you know, just typical Michigan fashion, shorts are four-season wear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a little crazy. Some days you just think, you know, maybe today is not a day for shorts, but... Today was a day for shorts for that guy.
Ugh, God, I can't imagine wearing shorts when it's this cold, but, you know, whatever. It's not for me, but if that's what makes you happy, I suppose.
Yeah, whatever gets you by, right?
Whatever, yeah, exactly. So I have a question for you. Do you know how many famous people there are from Michigan?
Like an actual number?
Yeah.
Ballpark?
Sure.
274.
Okay. I don't actually know the number, but there's a lot.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think fame is all, you know, what do you call it? Subjective.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, if you go to Wikipedia, there's actually a list of quote-unquote famous people that are either from Michigan or that have lived in Michigan or live in Michigan, and it's a very, very long list. So there's a ton of people.
It seems like there's constantly a anytime I see somebody like on TV or whatever, there seems to be some sort of Michigan link to pretty much everybody.
Yeah. Which is cool. I like it.
Yeah, it's cool, but I think it speaks, you know, generations of what do they call it, the brain drain of Michigan. You know, people stick around through high school, college, and then as soon as they're done with college, they leave.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot
so
of them.
Probably not the topic you wanted to get into today, but.
How do you mean?
The brain drain part.
Oh, yeah. No, we won't get into brain drain, but. But we are going to talk about some famous people that have either were born here, lived here, currently live here. So we're going to talk about a couple of them. I think I have four on my list today since it's, you know,
right.
We try to do like a 30-ish minute show. I don't want to go overboard, but
Right.
So first on the list is one of the most famous movie directors of our time, and that is John Hughes.
John Hughes.
Yeah, John Hughes was...
The great John Hughes, yeah.
He was born on February 18th, 1950 in Lansing, Michigan, to Marianne Crawford and John Hughes Sr. He was the only boy, and he had three sisters. He spent the first 12 years of his life in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, where he was a fan of Detroit Red Wings right winger Gordie Howe. In fact, one of Howe's number 9 jerseys, sent by Howe himself, was later displayed in Hughes' 1986 film Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
That's right.
In 1963, Hughes' family moved to Northbrook, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. Hughes attended Grove Middle School, later going on to Glenbrook North High School, which gave him inspiration for the films that eventually made his reputation.
I mean, that's really the city you associate with John Hughes is Chicago. I do, anyway. I mean, most of his movies seem to be based there.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a surprise when I found out that he lived here, that he was born here. I had no idea, so...
Makes sense. It's a two-way street between Chicago and Detroit.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was born in...
He met Nancy Ludwig, a cheerleader and his future wife, in high school. As a teen, Hughes turned to movies as an escape. According to childhood friend Jackson Peterson, quote, his mom and dad criticized him a lot. His mother would be critical of what John wanted to do. So he just kind of lost himself in movies.
I get that.
Yeah. After dropping out of the University of Arizona, Hughes began selling jokes to performers such as Rodney Dangerfield and Joan Rivers. He used his jokes to get an entry-level job as an ad copywriter in Chicago. During this time period, he created what became the famous Edge credit card shaving test ad campaign. Now, I don't remember that ad campaign, but it's probably before my time.
It sounds vaguely familiar,
mm-hmm.
But I probably, you know, I don't know exactly what it is, but I want to say maybe this is the Mandela effect or whatever, but I want to say I have, like, childhood memories of something to do with shaving and a credit card.
Okay. Well.
So, thank you, John Hughes, for that.
Hughes's work on the Virginia Slims account frequently took him to the Philip Morris headquarters in New York City, which allowed him to visit the offices of National Lampoon magazine.
Yeah.
Soon after, Hughes became a regular contributor. Editor P.J. O'Rourke recalled that John wrote so fast and so well that it was hard for a monthly magazine to keep up with him. One of Hughes' first stories, inspired by his family trips as a child, was Vacation 58, later to become the basis for the film National Lampoon's Vacation.
Yeah.
Another classic.
Yeah, an all-time classic. And you know what? I still enjoy Christmas Vacation every Christmas.
Oh, for sure. It's on the list. It is on the list.
First three, the first Vacation, European Vacation, Christmas Vacation. Boom, that's canon to me. I don't need the rest. Don't need Vegas Vacation. Don't need Christmas Vacation 2. First three are canon.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here shaking my head you're right. We don't need all those extra ones.
Now, even though the kids changed in every movie.
Which is weird.
Clark and his wife.
Yep. Hughes' directorial debut, 16 Candles, 1984, won almost unanimous praise when it was released, due in no small part to its more honest depiction of navigating adolescence and the social dynamics of high school life in stark contrast to the Porky's-inspired comedies made at the time. It was the first in a string of efforts about teenage life set in or around high school, including The Breakfast Club, 1985, Weird Science, 1985, and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, 1986, all of which he wrote and directed, and Pretty in Pink, 1986, and Some Kind of Wonderful, 1987, which he wrote and produced. Those movies are some of my favorite movies. They're
absolute classics.
Oh, God. Some Kind of Wonderful is so, so good. I haven't watched these in a really long time, and as I was doing the research for this, I was like, oh man, I really got to break out some of those old movies again.
I always got a soft spot for the old Weird Science.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fun one.
Yeah, it is. To avoid being pigeonholed as a maker of only teen movies, Hughes branched out in 1987 by writing, directing, and producing the hit comedy Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, starring Steve Martin and John Candy. His later output was not so well received critically, with films like Dutch, 1991, written and produced by Hughes, performing poorly at the box office. Films like Uncle Buck and National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, however, proved popular. His final film as a director was 1991's Curly Sue. By that time, in 1991, his John Hughes Entertainment Production Company had signed various deals with 20th Century Fox and Warner Brothers. Actor John Candy created many memorable roles in films written, directed, or produced by Hughes, including National Lampoon's Vacation, 1983, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, 87, The Great Outdoors, 88, Uncle Buck, 89, Home Alone, 1990, Career Opportunities, and Only the Lonely, both in 1991. Over the years, Hughes and Candy developed a close relationship. Hughes was greatly shaken by Candy's sudden death from a heart attack in 1994. He talked a lot about how much he loved Candy. If Candy had lived longer, I think John would have made more films as a director, says Vince Vaughn, a friend of Hughes. Uncle Buck is such a good movie, too. And The Great Outdoors. In fact, I think...
Yeah, although John Candy was just amazing.
Oh, God,
one of my all-time favorites.
He was brilliant. He was just... I wonder if he was still around, like how would he have helped to shape comedy in 2025? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
What role would he have to play if he was still around?
Right, and I mean, he's one of those guys who, definitely every time you'd see him, he'd just light up the screen.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
What I mean, like, just leave you with a good feeling whenever you saw him, like, oh yeah, John Candy.
Yep, I agree. Hughes' greatest commercial success came from Home Alone, a film he wrote and produced about a child accidentally left behind when his family goes away for Christmas, forcing him to protect himself and his house from a pair of inept burglars. Hughes completed the first draft of Home Alone in just 9 days. Home Alone was the top-grossing film of 1990 and remains the most successful live-action family comedy of all time.
How long is it supposed to take to write a movie?
Like, I don't know.
I don't know if that's a good mark or a bad mark. Like, written, like, the entire thing, like, no edits, anything like that? Sure, that's probably good.
Yeah. I've never tried to write a movie before, so...
Me neither. Now, I'm sorry I put that idea in your head.
Yeah, there's not very much room in my head for any more ideas and things. So I probably won't be writing a movie anytime soon, but...
All right, we'll see.
In 1994, Hughes retired from the public eye and moved back to the Chicago area. In the following years, Hughes rarely granted interviews to the media, save a select few in 1999 to promote the soundtrack album of Reach the Rock. The album was compiled by Hughes' son, John Hughes III, and released on his son's Chicago-based record label Hefty Records. He also recorded an audio commentary for the 1999 DVD release of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. On August 5th, 2009, Hughes and his wife traveled to New York City to visit their son James and their new grandson. James said his father appeared to be in good health that night and that the family had made plans for the next day. On the morning of August 6th, Hughes was taking a walk close to his hotel on West 55th Street in Manhattan, where he suffered a heart attack. He was rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, where he was pronounced dead at the age of 59.
That's crazy.
He's so young. I didn't realize how young he was. Yeah. So that's John Hughes.
Yeah.
He was just a great director, though. He and writer. He just very talented individual. So we're lucky that...
One of the best for... I mean, I would say our generation, even though we're younger, you know, I mean, we were raised on his films.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And a Lansing boy. Good to know. There's a couple of other Lansing, because I don't know if you're going to get into them, so I'm not going to talk about it.
But, yeah, we'll see. Yeah. Next up, known professionally as Tim Allen, Timothy Allen Dick was born June 13th, 1953 in Denver, Colorado. He is the third oldest of six children of Martha Catherine and Gerald Dick. Allen has two older brothers, two younger brothers, and a younger sister. His father died in a car accident in November of 1964, colliding with a drunk driver when Alan was 11. 2 years later, his mother married her high school sweetheart and moved with her six children to Birmingham, Michigan, to be with her new husband and his three children. Alan has said the move meant going from, quote, being in a cool group at one school to being at the bottom of the social hierarchy at another. Been there, my friend.
Yep. It's a problem with moving when you're young.
Yep. Alan attended Seaholm High School in Birmingham, where he was in theater and music classes. He then attended Central Michigan University before transferring to Western Michigan University in 1974. At Western Michigan, Alan worked at the student radio station. In 1976, he received a Bachelor of Science degree in communications, specializing in radio and television production, with a split minor in philosophy and design. Alan started his career at as a comedian in 1975. On a dare from one of his friends, he participated in a comedy night at Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, a suburb of Detroit. While in Detroit, he began to get recognition appearing in local television commercials and appearing on cable comedy shows such as Gary Thyssen's Some Semblance of Sanity. On October 2nd, 1978, Alan was arrested at the Kalamazoo Battle Creek International Airport for possession of over 650 grams of cocaine, which is just over a pound, if I remember correctly. And I mean, from my reading, not from anything that I've done.
Okay.
Just to clear that up. He pled guilty to felony drug trafficking charges and provided the names of other dealers in exchange for a sentence of 3 to 7 years rather than a possible life imprisonment.
He was paroled
on June 12th, 1981, after serving 2 years and 4 months in federal correctional institution Sandstone in Sandstone, Minnesota. Glad he got out of that. Jeez.
Yeah.
Following his release from prison, he returned to comedy. He moved to L.A. and became a regular performer at the Comedy Store. He began performing stand-up appearances on late-night talk shows and specials on record and film. In 1998, Western Michigan awarded him with an honorary fine arts degree and the Distinguished Alumni Award. Alan rose to fame in acting with the sitcom Home Improvement from 1991 to 1999. He played the main character Tim, the toolman Taylor, the father of three boys. Much of the show was based on his stand-up comedy act. In November of 1994, Alan simultaneously starred in the highest-grossing film, The Santa Claus, topped the New York Times bestseller list with his book, Don't Stand Too Close to a Naked Man, and appeared in the top-rated television series, Home Improvement, within 1 week. For his role on the show, Alan won a Golden Globe Award in 1995.
It really was Tim Allen's world during the 90s.
Yeah. And I, like, that's another one that I grew up on was Home Improvement. Like, yeah. I can't remember what day of the week it was on, but it was probably like a Friday night show. So we watched it as a family when I was growing up. So yeah.
You know, I was never a big Home Improvement fan. I think it was on ABC, right?
I think it was ABC. We watched a lot of Home Improvement. And then actually during quarantine, I'm sure you remember watching quite a bit of Home Improvement because it was on like MeTV or whatever that channel was that you could watch all those old TV shows. They would just kind of cycle through all of them. But Home Improvement was one of them.
I just remember watching a whole lot of Night Court.
Yeah.
Over and over again, thinking that the pandemic was going to end any week now.
Anytime.
All right, I'll just start back over from the beginning and watch it all again. I think I watched the entire series of the original Night Court like 4 times
back to back
before I was like, you know what, this isn't changing.
No. Yeah, it was like Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Also in 1995, Alan provided the voice of Buzz Lightyear in the Disney Pixar blockbuster Toy Story. In 1997, he starred in the family comedy Jungle to Jungle from Disney. In 1999, he returned to voice Buzz Lightyear in Toy Story 2, which was a financial and critical hit. That same year, he starred in the sci-fi parody Galaxy Quest alongside Sigourney Weaver, Alan Rickman, and Sam Rockwell. In 2002, he reprised his role as Scott Calvin in The Santa Claus 2. Alan began narrating the Pure Michigan television and radio commercials for the Travel Michigan agency. These commercials can be seen and heard throughout the Midwest and began airing nationally in 2009. Alan returned to ABC with the sitcom Last Man Standing from 2011 to 2021. He played the role of Mike Baxter, a conservative father fighting for his manhood in a house filled with women. The character is loosely based on his own life. Alan is a supporter of the Republican Party, describing himself as, quote, fiscally conservative and emotionally liberal. He is also involved in philanthropic efforts to help reduce homelessness. Fun fact about Tim Allen that I personally love. He purchased the former Shady Trails Camp on Lake Michigan in 1996 for $2 million. The camp is made up of 26 acres and 29 buildings. The University of Michigan held summer camps there from 1931 to 1995 for children with speech, language, and hearing disabilities. And from what I can tell, it was still used as a summer camp after he purchased the land.
Okay, that's cool then.
Yep. Tim Allen currently lives in California, but does still own a residence in Omena in Leelanau County.
Yeah, up there near north of Traverse City, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got an interesting story, that man.
Yeah, he does. And it's funny, I think about when I was a young man trying to do some stand-up comedy and meeting all the older Detroit comics, and everyone had Tim Allen stories. And
any that you can share?
I mean, I don't know. There's always, I think about, it was Ken Calvert, the former radio guy passed away, I think, last year.
Mm-hmm.
Good guy, used to be, on all the classic rock stations and all that. And he'd be like, man, we were like the Detroit Rat Pack. It was me, Mark Ridley, Tim Allen, and Bob Seger. And the four of us would hang out all the time. So I guess, they'd go golfing and all that together, those four.
Interesting. That's quite a group.
Yeah, I mean, they all had mustaches.
That was the prerequisite to be in the Detroit Rat Pack was,
I guess, so,
a good mustache.
Have a good mustache in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I know Tim Allen didn't make it big till he shaved his off.
Well, and, stopped trafficking cocaine.
Yeah.
So there's that.
yeah, that that definitely helped too. Changing his name.
Right.
Hey, think about it. This guy just came out, just decided to change up everything. Change his name, shave his mustache off. He's no longer a coke dealer. He's America's sweetheart. Tim Allen Dick, ladies and gentlemen.
That's all you gotta do.
Yeah.
So does the name Charles Nathaniel Agree mean anything to you?
Agree?
Yep.
No.
Okay. Well, it will, I'm sure. He was an American architect in Detroit. He was born on April 18th, 1897 in Stamford, Connecticut, and in 1909, at the age of 12, he moved to Detroit. He opened his firm in 1917 after graduating from the Detroit YMCA Technical School. His first major commission was in 1921 to build the Whittier Hotel near the bank of the Detroit River. He later went on to design many office buildings, theaters, and ballrooms. Agree was one of the Detroit architects of the 1920s and 30s who utilized the services of architectural sculptor Corrado Parducci.
Corrado Parducci?
Yep.
The Corrado Parducci?
Yes.
Okay.
You have no idea who that is, do you?
No, still waiting for the names to click.
Same. Anyway. They will in a second. As architecture changed in the 1960s, so did Agree's commissions. He began designing many modern-style malls. In addition to the office and the book tower, Agree's firm later opened an office on McNichols Road in Detroit and then a suburban office in Bloomfield Hills. Several Agree-designed buildings have been plundered by architectural scavengers. These include the Vanity Ballroom, where several Mayan deco panels were torn off, and the Grandy Ballroom, which brought rock band MC5 into fame, which has sat empty since closing in 1972.
And the world's largest dance floor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Other buildings, Other buildings designed by Charles Agree include Pilgrim and Puritan Apartment Complex in 1924, Bellcrest Apartments, previously Bellcrest Hotel in 1926, Harpo's Concert Theater in 1939, Nadel Furs Building in 1944, Southgate Shopping Center in 1957, and Oakland Mall in 1968.
Oh man, it's a real shame with Harpo's that he didn't develop self-cleaning technology as well.
Harpo's.
Sorry, Harpo's. You know I love you. I just had to.
Yeah.
A little dig in there.
He also designed.
It is part of the charm.
Yeah, if you're in a concert hall and your feet aren't sticking to the floor, I mean, what are you doing? What are you doing with your life?
You get knocked out. keeps you on your feet.
Sure does. Your
feet when the mosh pit breaks out.
Yep. He also designed the Panama City Mall in Panama City, Florida. The largest and most expensive of Agree's theater designs was the lavish Hollywood Theater in Southwest Detroit, built in 1927 in the Spanish Renaissance style at a cost of $2 million. Another major project of his was the Holden Reptile Building at the Detroit Zoo.
Oh, okay.
Charles Agree lived in the Boston Edison neighborhood and was a noted philanthropist in the Detroit area all of his life until his passing in 1982.
Interesting. Very nice to meet you, Charles.
Yeah, I figured you'd know who I was talking about once we started talking about the buildings.
Yeah, I know the buildings for sure. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So, to end the show, we're going to talk about someone who may not be well known, but she could have easily been in our Badass Babes of Michigan episode. Her name is Nancy Harkness Love. Born Hannah Lincoln Harkness on February 14th, 1914 in Houghton, Michigan, as the daughter of a wealthy physician, Harkness developed an intense interest in aviation at an early age. At 16, she took her first flight and earned her pilot's license within a month. Although she went to all the right schools, including Milton Academy in Massachusetts and Vassar in New York, she was restless and adventurous. In 1932, by the end of her freshman year, dubbed the Flying Freshman, she earned her commercial license and received national attention. At Vassar, she earned extra money taking students for rides in aircraft she rented from a nearby airport. In 1936, Harkness married Robert M. Love, an Air Corps Reserve major. They built their own successful Boston-based aviation company, Intercity Aviation, for which Nancy was a pilot. She also flew for the Bureau of Air Commerce. Love entered air races in 1936 and 1937, competing in the national air races in LA and Detroit. After finishing second in the Detroit race, she stopped competing. In 1937 and 1938, Love worked as a test pilot alongside famous air racer Frank Hawks for the Gwynn Air Car Company, performing tests on various aircraft modifications and innovations. In one project, she served as a test pilot on the new tricycle landing gear, which subsequently became standard on most aircraft. In another project, she helped mark water towers with town names as a navigational aid for pilots. I found that really interesting because I had no idea. Like, you know, you always see water towers with their name of the city printed on it, and it's just like, oh, that's just a thing, but they did it for navigational aid. I had no idea. That's so cool.
Yeah, that's crazy. And, you know, I'm still hung up on the air races thing. Is that still a thing? Like, outside of, like, seeing those Red Bull-like ads on YouTube?
I don't know.
Like, do you ever see, like, air races anymore? Like, people just put together their own airplanes and race each other?
Probably not.
I mean, it's a cool thought.
It is. Yeah.
Like, air demolition derby? I don't know.
Well,
similar vibe, but hopefully not.
Hopefully not, yeah.
Your figure eights over the fairground?
I don't know about that. In May of 1940, after World War II broke out in Europe, Love wrote to Lieutenant Colonel Robert Olds, then in the Plans Division of the U.S. Air Corps headquarters, but who a year later would be in charge of establishing the Air Corps Ferrying Command, that she had found 49 excellent women pilots. This group, called the Originals, each had more than 1,000 flying hours. She proposed that the women could help transport aircraft from factories to bases. Olds submitted a plan for integrating civilian female pilots in the ferrying command to General Hap Arnold, commanding general of the U.S. Army Air Forces, who turned it down after Jacqueline Cochran extracted a promise from him not to act on any proposal regarding women pilots that did not make them commissioned officers commanded by women. In early 1942, her husband Robert was called to active duty in the munitions building in Washington, D.C., as the deputy chief of staff at the ferrying command. Love accompanied him to Washington and on March 11 took a civil service position in Baltimore, Maryland, with the operations office of the ferrying command's Northeast Sector, which was soon redesignated 2nd Ferrying Group, Domestic Division. The Domestic Division, commanded by Colonel William H. Tunner, was designated Ferrying Division, Air Transport Command a few months later. Love piloted her own aircraft on her daily commute from the couple's home in Washington, D.C. The offices of Major Love and Colonel Tunner were near each other, and during a conversation between them, her piloting skills caught the attention of Tunner, who was scouring the country for skilled pilots to deliver aircraft from factories to fields. Major Love suggested Tunner speak to his wife directly. Love convinced Tunner that the idea of using experienced women pilots to supplement the existing pilot force was a good one. He then asked her to write up a proposal for a women's ferrying division. When his recommendation that she and other female pilots be commissioned into the Women's Army Corps was denied, he appointed her to his staff as executive of women's pilots. Within a few months, she had recruited 30 experienced female pilots to join the newly created Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron. 28 graduated from training, and Love became their commander. In September of 1942, the women pilots began flying from Newcastle Army Airfield, Wilmington, Delaware, under the auspices of the 2nd Ferrying Group. By June 1943, Love was commanding 4 different squadrons of the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron at Love Field, Texas, Newcastle, Delaware, Romulus, Michigan, and Long Beach, California. The squadron's number had greatly increased because of the addition of graduates of the Women's Flying Training Detachment at Avenger Field, Sweetwater, Texas, an organization championed and headed by Jacqueline Cochran. On August 5, 1943, the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron and the Women's Flying Training Detachment merged to become a single entity, the Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASP for short. Love was named the executive for all WASP ferrying operations. Under her command, female pilots flew almost every type of military aircraft then in the Army Air Force's inventory, and their record of achievement proved remarkable. Love was certified in 19 military aircraft, becoming the first woman to be certified to fly the latest military aircraft, including the Douglas C-54 Skymaster, North American B-52 Mitchell, and along with Betty Gillies, the first to fly the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress. In Dallas, Love was also checked out on the North American P-51 Mustang, the USAAF's hottest fighter. In 1944, after the WASPs were disbanded, Love continued to work on reports detailing the work of the Air Transport Command. At the end of the war, Love and her husband had the unique distinction of being decorated simultaneously. He received the Distinguished Service Medal and she the Air Medal for her operational leadership and the successful training and assignment of over 300 qualified women flyers in the flying of advanced military aircraft. After the war, Love had 3 daughters, but she continued as an aviation industry leader, as well as a champion for recognition as military veterans for the women who had served the WASPs. In 1948, after the creation of the United States Air Force, she was given the rank of Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Air Force Reserve. Love died of cancer at the age of 62 in 1976, so she did not live to see the WASPs being accorded military recognition 3 years later. She was posthumously inducted into the Airlift Tanker Association in 1996, the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame in 1997, and the National Aviation Hall of Fame in Dayton, Ohio in 2005. A statue dedicated to Nancy Harkness Love is at the Newcastle County Airport in Delaware.
Very cool. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I had never heard of her before, and that's very interesting. Very cool.
Yeah, yeah. She She was a bad bee.
Yeah.
She just kept pushing.
Right. Just got it done.
Mm-hmm.
Recognized.
It's crazy too, just to think like. I mean, let's see. It was in the 40s when all this was happening, and which, you know, we talk about how long, like how long ago things seem, and the 40s, you know, they were a while ago. Obviously, it was before our time, but in the grand scheme of things, the 1940s weren't that long ago, and she was an experienced, a very experienced pilot, and they were like, no. We don't.
Right. No, it's crazy that you say that because it's, I don't know. I think I saw some, like, clip on Facebook the other day, like a reel just going through and, you know, just one little clip of, like, some old TV show from the 60s or whatever, like a prank. It was Candid Camera. An old Candid Camera from the 60s where they were pranking people by making them think that they were going to have a female pilot for their flight. You know, on a commercial airline, and just the way people were freaking out, like, that's the pilot? No, come on.
Wow.
And yeah, it's just kind of funny. And that was probably, what, the 60s or 70s when that was filmed?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's always been an uphill battle, ladies. I'm sorry.
That's really disappointing.
No, it is. I mean, even when you think you're a trailblazer, turns out the next generation just has to re-blaze those trails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then to think she wasn't even inducted into the Hall of Fame until the 90s, the late 90s at that. And then the Aviation Hall of Fame not until 2005.
Right.
Like, she should have been given that recognition, you know, back before she passed away in 76.
Right. The day it happened?
Yeah, or that. I mean... There's a thing. So yeah, those are some famous people that from Michigan.
Very interesting and a nice selection. I mean, we could do shows like this till the end of time.
Oh, I know. There's a ton.
Just about famous people. Just a random four pack of famous people from Michigan that have nothing in common.
Yeah.
Like nothing. Like no, we won't have like any theme to the show. You know, it'll just be like today we're going to talk about. You know, Bishop Baraga, Steven Seagal, Joe C., and Wes Borland.
Oh, is Wes Borland from Michigan?
I don't know. I mean, you would know.
I don't know.
I just threw that in there.
That's funny. That's super random. But yeah, we could. Yeah. I mean, we totally could. Next week, actually, I was trying to find like hidden gems. Like, I'm always Googling weird stuff because I'm like, I don't know what to talk about. So I'll Google like the most weird things. So hidden gems of Michigan is what I Googled. And I actually found a really interesting stuff about the Jefferson Chalmers neighborhood that I had no idea about, and so that's what we're going to talk about next week.
Okay, good. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it should be awesome. So just
anytime you find out something new about Michigan that you think must be told, I'm all ears.
I love it. That's the way.
At this point, how much more is there left to learn? A ton.
There's so much. And what is so cool about when we talk about Jefferson Chalmers' neighborhood, there's going to be some tie-ins to a couple of other shows that we've already done.
Yes.
And I, like, you know how exciting that makes me, or how excited that makes me. I just love being able to connect the dots and see, like, it's almost like you're seeing, like, this whole big thing, like, come together. It's like you're putting a puzzle together, and it's so fun
you
to me.
You're a part of it. You're part of the Michigan dream.
Woo! Sorry,
I'm trying to be all uplifting here at the end of the show.
Heck yeah. I love it.
One vision, one dream. Welcome to Michigan. Pure whoop. Michigan.
Whoop, whoop.
Whoop, whoop. Pure Michigan. Everything's all tied together now.
We did it. Yay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
End of series.
And done. We are just actually
next week we'll be back talking about Jefferson Chalmers.
Yeah, we'll be back next week for sure. But we will be wrapping up this season soon. We're going to do 20 episodes, and this is going to be episode 14, so we're getting closer to the end of this season, but then we'll take off the summer and do some exploring, and then we'll come back in the fall again. So
spooky season.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm excited.
Yeah.
Good stuff. All right.
Yep.
Well, that's all I got. So I guess we'll,
Sorry. Good one. I liked it.
All right, so we'll chat at you guys next week. We'll be talking about Jefferson Chalmers. If you have anything that you want us to, if you have any show suggestions or you have a story about something we've already chatted about, please feel free to email us at greatlakesconfidential@gmail.com, or you can send us a message on Facebook. We do get quite a few messages on Facebook about show suggestions and things of that nature, so I definitely read those.
Maybe if you want to hip us to a famous person that they think we might not know about from Michigan.
Heck yeah.
Connection to somebody.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
Let us know.
Hey, if you're a famous person in Michigan, let's chat.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, fame is subjective, so.
That's true. That is true.
You know, maybe you're a big thing, you know, you're a big deal in the air racing scene in Michigan.
And we don't even know about it. Yeah, we definitely want to hear about that.
Right. Kind of reminds me of, I remember like talking to a friend of mine who is a DJ in Florida, and he was like, well, I can't say I'm famous, but I'm genre famous. So if your genre is Michigan and you're famous, give us a holler.
He's genre famous.
Yeah.
All right, that's cool. I mean, we all have our things, so.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
What if somebody like super like really famous like messaged me and was like, I'd love to be on your show. Like Dax Shepard is out there listening to me babble on about Michigan stuff, and he calls me up and he's like, I want to be a guest on your show.
Let's talk about Howell.
That'd be crazy.
Yeah. Hi, this is Tom Gores, owner of the Detroit Pistons.
Maybe Amon Ross St. Brown is listening.
Yeah. Great job. Great job. By the way, keep up the good work.
Yeah, for sure.
You and Amon Ra.
Me and Amon Ra. Yeah, we're really... Man. I'm really out here killing it.
Gruesome twosome.
And on that note, it is time to start prepping for the game tonight, so...
Yes.
Got to make sure all my house chores are done, and because they got a big one at the time of this recording, they got a big one tonight against the Vikings, and
the biggest game in Detroit history.
I'm nervous.
I mean, since we lost the, I mean, I don't want to lose it by any means, but if we lose, we're still in the playoffs. We just have to run the gauntlet.
Yeah.
It's just silly.
Yeah.
It's just silly, but it just goes to show you how good the Vikings are.
I know, and that's why I'm nervous.
Really all about four teams right now. Every other team can just kiss off.
Which four teams are we talking?
The Lions and the Vikings in the NFC, and then over in the AFC, you got the Chiefs and the Bills. Man. And if those aren't your final four going into the old Super Bowl, then I'll be a monkey's uncle.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'm just rambling. I'm no sports expert here. I'm just rambling.
Well, you know more than I do.
I don't know. Do I?
I think so.
Does any of it really matter? Does any of it matter in the end of the day?
It doesn't. The only thing that matters is that Detroit Lions are going to win today, and they're going to be the number one seed, and they're... What else happens? They don't have to go on the road, and...
They get a bye week.
They get a bye week.
For the playoffs.
Yeah.
Rest.
Yeah.
I'm sure if they get that week of rest, then Aiden Hutchinson will be back.
Oof.
I don't think so, but I mean...
Yeah.
Might as well think high, right? Like, if we get 1 week of rest, then every injured Lion will return.
Wouldn't that be like something?
Like Return of the King? And then when all the ghosts show up at the end? And just wipe the floor with everybody.
Hell yeah.
Throughout the playoffs. Easy win at the Super Bowl.
We're speaking it into existence right now.
Yes.
So
get your spectral vengeance upon the rest of the NFL.
Yep.
Bobby Lane, led by the ghost of Bobby Lane. Led into combat by the ghost of Bobby Lane and George Karras, Webster's dad.
Webster's
George Papadopoulos. You'll be there.
Yeah.
Mongo.
Now you're just getting weird.
I know. It's football day. I better let you go. Go get ready for the big game.
Heck yeah.
And we'll reconvene later.
Sounds
more Michigania.
Sounds great to me. You have a great week and be safe out there. Watch for deer. Text us when you get home.
Bye.
Bye.